Good day to one and all, no matter where you may be. Kirk, it's my pleasure to be with you here today on Observations.
And I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
We're going to begin a journey that is going to consume considerable amount of time, but this is the first of our systematic kind of beginning to end review of the book known today as Isaiah. It's actually Yashaya or Yashayahu. It's written both ways in the text. It means salvation is from Yahweh. And so what I wanted to do, because there was a method to the madness, if you will, of writing observations. We started on Proverbs 6, which specifically denounces Paul and Pauline Christianity, and was written from a father to his son. This would be our Heavenly Father to the children of the covenant, to tell them what things God expressly despises, who he hates, and what we ought to do if we don't want to fall victim to religion. And from there, we went to the seventh chapter of 2 Samuel, and we presented what God had to say about religion. Specifically, as he talked about, and God doesn't much differentiate between religion and government.
No.
He looks at them as really being the same foe, that religion and government have always been integrated throughout history, and they are control mechanisms over his people that limit their freedoms and deceive and enrich themselves unfairly. So we consider what God had to say about religion in the first book of Samuel. Then we went from there to what God had to say specifically about government. And, you know, he had those 12 scathing comments about,
if you want a king,
if you want a king, you want a ruler, this is what you're going to get. And you're going to get constant war. He's going to, you know, your sons are going to die. Your daughters are going to be abused. You're going to be taxed into oblivion, all to create this massive enterprise that satiates the desires strictly of the king. From there, we went into Proverbs 7, which is written really as a partner to Proverbs 6. And there God specifically delineates the way that the Whore of Babylon disguises herself. It's actually the adversary disguises himself or herself, depending on how you want to look at the metaphor, to deceive billions of people. And in Proverbs 7, God specifically names Paul as the principal spokesperson for the Whore of Babylon. And so once we had finished his specific denunciations of Paul, we turned to Chabaouk and went through the second chapter of Chabaouk, first and second chapters of Chabaouk, where God specifically also calls out Paul by name and calls him the plague of death, so that we'd understand that this is an overall theme of God.
Yeah. Everywhere you go, plague of death.
Yeah. So the purpose of turning to Yashaya at this point is that there is the connections between the whore of Babylon, mm-hmm. and Satan and religion. So those things,
right.
The whore, Satan, Babylon, and religion are all connected in Yashaya. As you move through the first 14 chapters of Yashaya, God systematically explains that the whore is the whore of Babylon, and that the whore of Babylon is in fact Satan, and that the institution that Satan establishes to manifest himself as the whore of Babylon, or to work as the whore of Babylon, he actually does it to be seen as the Lord God, is religion. That's the mechanism, and so it's all laid out for us in Isaiah, and that's why we've turned to Isaiah now to to view that. So what I'd like to do, Kirk, something we don't very often do, but I want to systematically explain why we're turning to Isaiah, when it was written, why the timing of its writing was interesting, to put it into the context of the history of Israel, because that's the thing that God cares the most about, and that's what he's writing about through this prophet. And then to explain what other things are kind of going on at this time. So we really have a framework to understand this, because there's some things that are said early on that are really, really troubling. I mean, it's, wow, it just grabs your heart and squeezes.
Yeah. If you don't see America in all these passages, if you don't see the church in all these passages, then something's wrong with your head.
That is correct. I mean, that's correct. And God's, for those who would say, you know, God's not specifically mentioned, that's not true.
Oh.
Yeah, that's not true. That is just not true. Like when he speaks of the merchants of Tarshish and how the merchants of Tarshish in the last days will be so detrimentally influential on the world. And when you drill down to figure out, and we will as we go through this, you drill down to figure out who they were at that time and what they did that at that time to have them be the metaphor, the symbol for a country that will mirror their nature in the last days. There's only one country that matches them, and we'll find out. That's the United States.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, those of us in the English frame, we have to remember that all these verbs are not set in time, and all prophecy has to be true.
Over all time.
Past, present, and for all time. He's not, even though this may be associated with Assyria or something else at one time or another, it's also very much this day that we live in as well.
So. Correct. Yes, as a matter of fact, most of it is pointed to our time.
Yes, I see that. I can't imagine anyone can see otherwise, but just for the skeptic.
Yeah, and there's another aspect of it, too, that is interesting, is that there'll be people that read it today, read these words, and they'll think that, okay, God is speaking out against Judaism. Well, Christianity replaced Judaism, so we don't like Judaism either, so we agree with God. No, you know, knit to Judaism. But he wasn't speaking about Judaism.
No, it wasn't there.
Yeah, what didn't exist? There was no such religion then.
No.
You know, we're talking in the 8th century BCE, Judaism as a religion didn't really manifest itself until the time of the Maccabees. Mm-hmm. And so you're looking more at its initiation maybe around 400 BCE, but really playing into, really right around 200 BCE is when Judaism actually emerges in its various forms as a religion. And it came out in really three forms, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes. Yeah, those were the three forms of Judaism that emerged during the occupation of Alexander the Great's descendants, not really descendants, but the four generals as they carved up the territory that Alexander had conquered, their control over and influence on Israel is what caused rabbinic Judaism to grow. And today there's only one surviving form of the religion, the
Pharisaical.
And that's the Pharisaical form of the religion. The rabbinical form of the religion is all that exists today. But this was 500 years before Judaism existed. Mm-hmm. So the religion that's being described here is a variation of the Babylonian religion. In fact, it's not even a significant variation. It's the same names, the same characters, the same gods, the same terminology, the same festivals. Everything about the religion that God is denouncing here is Babylonian. Mm-hmm. And the most Babylonian religion on the planet today
is Catholic, the Roman Catholic.
Yes, correct.
Or Christianity in general.
Christianity in general, right. Roman Catholicism specifically, and Christianity in general. And you might say, well, that's a stretch. No, it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it's not a stretch is that God specifically tells us in Daniel that out of Babylon will come the Persians. And out of the Persians, they will ultimately be defeated by Alexander and the Greeks. And that Alexander and the Greek empire would be defeated by Rome.
Right.
And each of these beasts, and they're beasts, which means they're satanic in terms of their religion and their government, would grow progressively worse, but really all evolving one out of another from Babylon until at the end, Imperial Rome, which God denounces as is horrific. And I wrote an entire chapter covering the viciousness of Imperial Rome so that people would understand the history of Rome and how, you know, there's this grandeur of Rome delusion in people's eyes. Rome
is romantic society. It's not romantic.
Yeah. It's the most despicable culture, nation, in human history was Rome. That just in every imaginable bad thing, the Romans did. And you know, if you question that, I would encourage you to read, open the seventh chapter of yadayah.com, and it's free. Read it and get an eyeful as to what Imperial Rome was. But God said that's not the worst of the beasts. He said out of Imperial Rome comes the worst beast, and that's the beast that will survive right to the end days, the last days, and that beast would trample upon the whole world.
And there's only one candidate for that.
The Roman Catholic Church. And I wrote an entire chapter that talks about the transition from Imperial Rome to the Roman Catholic Church. And it was not consummated by Constantine, which everybody thinks, but by Theodosius.
Right.
Who was both the Pope and the Emperor of Rome. He was the last Pope and Emperor of Rome when Rome was still united, although he would rule out of Constantinople.
Right.
And so,
he's controlling both sides, yeah.
Right. So while Yahweh describes America using, it must be 50 different insights that leave no other choice but America as the country that is most to blame for the divestiture of Israel, for severing the nation at the waist and making it vulnerable to the Muslims and supplying the Muslims with the weapons that they would wield against Israel. And God goes out of his way to express his disdain for this country, the United States. You'd have to be blind not to see Roman Catholicism and therefore Christianity and the United States in these words.
Yeah. There are no other candidates.
No, there aren't. We're it. That does not make, you know, other places good, you know, like South and Central America.
Hanging right with us. And
that is
the Muslim world is going right after them, doing it. And yeah, China's no better, and Russia's no better either.
Yep. So the most prolific of Yahweh's prophets was aptly named, Salvation is from Yahweh. Isn't it a shame that religious scholars, I mean, just scumbags of individuals, saw fit to change the names of people that God had inspired to speak for him?
Mm-hmm. And so that we know what they're talking about.
Right.
I mean, the story is in the name.
Right. If in fact, you knew that the book was scribed by Yeshayah, you would know that it was that he bore Yahweh's name, and that Yesh is one of the most common of all Hebrew verbs.
Mm-hmm.
Means to save.
Right.
Salvation is from Yahweh. You lose that if you revert to Isaiah. Why do that? I mean, there is not a single Hebrew scholar in the world today that doesn't know that the man's name was Yeshayah.
Yeah. You can look him up in all the lexicon. Right. That's what it is.
I mean, the only difference between Yahusha, which every scholar in the world knows is the actual name of the person who was changed to Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference between Yeshayah and Yahusha is that the order of the name and the verb are reversed.
Right.
Yahweh saves, salvation is from Yah.
Well, how about also, just a little aside, they seem to get, these translators seem to get all of the names for Satan and all the bad guys right.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, that is such a slap in the face. I want to kill them myself.
I agree.
Yeah.
They only goof on once with Satan. They you know, Hasatan is the Hebrew word for adversary, and so they use Satan as
like,
it's a name, and it's not a name. Satan is a title.
Yeah.
Twice in this book, and the book named Salvation is from Yahweh, Yeshayah. Satan is named. You know, the adversary is named. It's Hillel ben Shakar. They changed it to Lucifer.
By error, right.
Yeah. I mean, oh, goodness. Okay, so Yeshayah spoke of the fleeting vestiges of Israel, delineating what the northern kingdom had done to anger God and to engender their own annihilation at the hands of the Assyrians. Yeshayahu's, Isaiah's message was also for those who would listen in Yehudah, Judah. Fortunately, they did. They would even recover, although for a short period of time, because one of their kings discovered a copy of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
He read it.
Yes, he did.
And he and his nation, Yehudah, the southern part of the kingdom, was rejuvenated by observing its guidance. Enjoying
the longest Passover in history.
Yeah, that's right. They did. They just had so much fun, they doubled the length. And they enjoyed a century of peace and prosperity as a result. Gotcha. 2 weeks of celebration, you got a century of peace. It's a pretty good deal.
Pretty good deal.
Pretty good deal. And they even had, and they stretched it 2 weeks, and they were having so much fun.
Yeah.
Beyond these people, Yeshayahu's prophetic pronouncements were scribed for us in the present day, and for what will soon befall the chosen people, both good and bad, all in our immediate future. Now, the reason we can say that without any speculation is that there are huge swaths of Yeshayahu's prophetic testimony that deal with events playing out right before our eyes. You know, like Yeshayahu 17 speaks of the Syrian war that's going on right now.
Right.
And the aftermath of the Syrian war, and who the belligerents are in the civil war, and who's arming the belligerents in the Syrian war, and what's ultimately going to happen as a result of that. And by the way, it's not just the term that Yahweh uses for Syria, literally meant greater Syria. And so it includes Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Jordan and other countries in that.
As well.
Right. So, and it specifically talks about that the triggering event that's going to really bring all of this into into focus is that ultimately Damascus is going to fall and become a heap of rubble. And once it falls, all hell breaks loose.
Or even better, a twisted heap of rubble.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that, what Yahweh is telling us is the same thing that we should have learned from our invasion of Iraq or our invasion of Libya. And that is that dictators, while bad, and, you know, Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi were horrendous people.
Sure.
But if you're not careful and you depose a dictator, no matter how bad they are, if you don't know what the majority of the people think and are like and are likely to do, then you put yourself in a position where you get something much worse. We got something much worse in Libya. We got something much worse in Iraq. And so that was the consequence of replacing a tyrant with a religious government. So this is very serious. God is saying the same thing about us in what's going to happen when we impose. For example, where the United States is in opposition to Assad, the president of Syria, not recognizing that what happened in Iraq, what happened in Libya, will happen in Syria and is going to happen in Syria when Assad is deposed.
Spread to all the other countries right around.
Correct. That's exactly what's going to happen. And God tells us, yeah, that's what's going to happen. You Americans are so stupid. You're going to go and remove three dictators from power, and you're going to turn those three countries into hellholes for Islamic terrorism. what he tells us. And he says, not holding anything back. It's unambiguous. So as a result of finding a complete 2,200-year-old scroll of Yeshaya, nestled between the Dead Sea and Jerusalem, fortuitously protected inside of masonry vessels in the caves of Qumran, we have access to a text that predates the deliberate and rather sinister corruptions of Judaism and of Christianity. It provides absolute proof that God exists, that his name is Yahweh, and that he authored the words that we're going to consider. Now, while much of what Yahweh inspired his prophets to write is painful to consider, especially as God laments about what religion and politics have done to corrupt his children, his awe-inspiring prophecies punctuate his treatise on the darkness of man with overwhelmingly powerful overtures that will enrich and enlighten the willing. The message about to be unfurled before our eyes is at times depressing, but also uplifting, because for every affliction there is an answer. And sadly, even though the benefits of Yahweh's covenant are beyond our wildest imaginings, there'd be very few takers. And for centuries, according to God, there were none. God couldn't find a single person to work with. You know, and God's criterion for people to work with isn't very high.
No. Case in point.
Yeah, absolutely. It ain't very high.
For God.
He said, but there's none. Yeah, there's none. Throughout the prophetic text and over the course of 2,700 years of human history, past, present, and future, Yahweh introduces us to the world's most formidable adversary. He systematically reveals and speaks about the role of the Whore of Babylon and how this Whore of Babylon misleads his children so that they not only rebel against him, but they actually come to worship Satan as if he were God. Now, Yosha does a marvelous job of pulling all this together for Yahochanan in the concluding chapters of Revelation. And we're going to consider what is said there, because the case between Satan, Babylon, the whore, and religion are very succinctly brought together when Yosha summarizes what we're going to read here over the course of these 14 chapters of Yeshaya. Now, this not only talks about Satan positioning himself to be worshipped as God, and he is the God of Christianity. Satan is the God of Islam.
Staggering.
Yeah, the sinful nation, which is presented here, is very reminiscent of our own. And it's compared to Sodom and Gomorrah. Yahweh bluntly states that their religious prayers and their offerings are absolutely worthless. He views them as an abomination.
Boy, staggering.
It's staggering. You know, all this, you know, they had this terrible tragedy down there in Orlando, and everybody, the first thing they apologize, they say, yeah, we ought to pray. Pray for the families. Pray for the victims, pray for the families. Why would you pray for anybody? I mean, what good is that going to do? First of all, God doesn't even hear the prayers of those who are not part of the covenant. And those who are part of the covenant know there's absolutely nothing you can do for those people or for their families.
No.
Nothing. You know, the killer was religiously motivated, and yet the focus of the nation is on guns. It's just mind-bogglingly stupid.
If you took all the guns away from all the Muslims in the world, would they still kill each other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that being the case, I wouldn't do what America is doing and send billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of advanced weaponry to the Islamic nations.
But the point is, if people are motivated to kill you, they'll take a knife, they'll take a rock.
Yeah.
Started with Cain and Abel. They'll take
correct.
A rock and just kill you.
That's correct. That is absolutely correct. You don't need a gun to do it. So throughout this prophetic text, we are going to see that the misguided notion that somehow Judaism is being assailed by God and he's giving up on his chosen people, it's just not the case. Judaism did not exist. Their political and religious presumptions of that God is discussing are actually pervasive today in the West. And this should be especially alarming to Christians. And that the religion of Christianity was inspired by these exact same influences. I mean, there are 100 things that we could share with you that are essential to Christianity that were born and bred in Babylon. Sunday worship, Easter, Christmas, Lent, the Trinity, steeples, crosses.
Yes.
A God called the Lord.
Yeah.
All of it.
Oh.
It's all Babylonian.
Paid clergy.
Paid
by
clergy.
The way.
Yep.
On and on and on. Steeples.
Mm-hmm. God is unequivocal, explicitly condemning religious opposition to his Torah. What is the most religiously opposed institution in the world today, vis-a-vis the Torah?
Oh, that would be against it. It would be the Christianity.
Yeah, Pauline Christianity. Yeah. The Quran claims to confirm the Torah. No, it doesn't. It's the antithesis of the Torah.
That's
but that's
so
just
stupid.
That's just so stupid. It hurts.
That ain't a good argument. You can't
But Paul specifically condemns the covenant and the covenant and the Torah.
Yeah.
Saying that it's incapable of saving anyone. It enslaves. It's of the flesh. It's, you know, it's ruinous.
Yeah.
So continuing his assault on the mind-numbing aspects of human rhetoric and resulting beliefs, Yahweh introduces the cure, his Torah and his son, the latter walking out of the pages of the former. Through his prophet, Yahweh ascribes religious rebellion to a perverted and duplicitous whore. By the time we reach the 13th and 14th chapters, this adversarial religious harlot is linked directly to Babylon and then directly to Satan himself. This systematic progression from Sodom to Babylon, from rebellion to religion, from worthless prayers and offerings to the adversary, leads to announcing the name of the author of these corruptions, adroitly delineating the reason Satan conceived and advanced religion to beguile the preponderance of people throughout the ages into worshiping the devil as their Lord. Now, when we began Observations as Our Time, listening to Yahweh explain why he hates the advocates of religion and the proponents of politics and why he considers them to be an abomination for having discounted and discarded his Torah, I'm reminded that so many people, every time there's a horrible incident in the world, they come out and say, well, all of this was because of hate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hate is what caused Orlando. No, it didn't. It's a lack of hate.
You've got to hate the right thing.
Right. It's because the vast preponderance of people have not yet come to hate the religion that inspired those acts.
Yeah.
And if you don't hate that which promotes that kind of viciousness, if you don't hate that which promotes kidnapping and an enslavement of children and of rape and of pedophilia and of jihad and of terrorism, then you are destined to endure the consequence. It's we don't hate enough is the reason Orlando occurred. It's not because of hate. So that's what we learned, that God hates religion for the exact same reason we ought to hate it.
Right.
Now, the second chapter, we specifically focused on God's denunciation of religion. And the third, we listened to him excoriate government. Oh, boy, he is. This idea of God bless America, you have to be a nincompoop to think that God is blessing any country, much less America. In the fourth chapter, Yah told us that he would support and enable our willingness to criticize these human institutions, protecting us from them as a process. Yeah, in my summary in this earlier in this program, I forgot to mention that. We devoted an entire chapter to this 91st Psalm, where God is specifically saying, if you're willing to do what I want done, which is to expose and condemn religion and speak of my testimony. I'll protect you.
Indeed he does.